Hello, welcome, and thank you all for coming tonight. It's a pleasure to be introducing to you David Baker, whose love for poetry and his dedication to it has branched itself in so many directions. He's not only the author of 8 books of poems, he's also written, edited, and co-edited 3 collections of critical essays. He's the poetry editor of the Kenyon Review and is also a professor of English at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. It's easy when you're asked the question, what poets have influenced you, to rattle off a few names without thinking about it very much. But most of us, I think, would have to pause if asked, well, what single poet has influenced you most? But I don't have to pause, because for me, actually, there's very little question. And it's funny because, while it's always clear to me that the year and a half that I studied under David Baker, that helped me become a better writer. But it wasn't actually until last spring when I revisited his work that it actually floored me how profoundly his aesthetics have shaped not only what I aspire in my own writing, but also what I value in the writing of others. In his introduction to Radiant Liar, he quotes Yeats as saying, "We make of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but with the quarrel ourselves, poetry." And I think that it's this, not querulous, but restless interrogation of how to perceive the world and how to respond to it emotionally, that I find myself continue to be influenced by his work, and while always continue to return to it. To me, this lyrical cross-examination is sort of typified in the poem Monarchs Landing and Flying. It opens his latest collection. The 24 lines that begin this poem direct our attention to this young couple who are looking nowhere but each other's eyes, and then to the fluttering monarchs, and then back to the couple, but something's happened. They're no longer looking at each other. The woman is weeping, and the man, his emotional response is unclear. They leave in a taxi cab. David Baker begins that 24th line with the poem with the phrase, "Nothing stirring in the garden," which would be so cynical if it ended there, but the line continues. Nothing stirring in the garden, not us. And suddenly we realize that the narrator is observing this scene, while perhaps saddened by what he's observed, is also being comforted by something he values. In an earlier poem entitled The Anniversary of Silence, he writes, "Once there was beauty even in the wreckage men made of the world." And it's that interrogation of beauty, that relentless questioning of it, that instead of diminishing it, actually makes the beauty he sees in the world more resonant in his poetry. He also writes in the introduction to The Radiant Liar that poetry is itself a kind of persuasion. And actually that's more true than what Yeats said. Poetry can quarrel with others. It can take a stance, and it certainly changed the mind of an arrogant, cynical, angry young 20-year-old and persuaded them that, no, actually there is beauty in this wreckage. It's a tremendous honor tonight to introduce to you David Baker.
One gets very fond of one's students. Even years later, the first thing I thought when Steve began to talk was, voices. He hasn't been getting enough sleep. His voice is raspy. He stayed up too late last night. He needs a Ludens. But I don't have any cough drops or anything. But you worry about them. So I go to Ron Smith's school today and meeting these wonderful young men at St. Christopher's School, and I look out at the teachers, and there's another one of my students who's been teaching there for 20 years, Mr. Burke. Come home. The earth utters to the body. And so the body does come home at last. Consider the tufts and tail piece, hooves cleft from the legs. The legs, what's left of them where they dropped concentric beneath the beach. Consider the beach, the lover's own tree. This one, yes, hearts scored in, and someone's and someone else's initials so swollen they're unreadable and more than head high up the trunk. Up the trunk, where the body crawled. Think of that. Furious, rapt hunger. We thought it a rumor when the farmer called the paper. When deputies spotted something, buff deer, or maybe a Dane running loose in the corn, in the feedlot, three nights running. Look, there is no doubt whatever. So the body, even the lover, comes down to earth. But not this time at first. The big cat dragged the corpse up the tree. They will do that. That's how we know, cats being climbers with prey they've killed, up by the bowl, to the big place, to the crotch of the tree. That's what we call it. And crouched, ate, shat, even slept. The claw marks proceed up the tree. The fleshy, dun bark, blood stripped brown as fox coat or wet sandstone, blood ascending the tree's evident body. Up the lover's tree. Then the body fell, at least in little pieces, all around the trunk, spattered, strewn, areole of deer guts, bitten skin, bone. The rest went on again in the body of the beast. And so we hear the lovers do this too. That one happened. We had this big cat in the backwoods. So this is the poem Steve was talking about. I think I'll read this one. Monarchs Landing and Flying. Just a simple little love poem. If they have come for the butterflies, then bless their breaking hearts. But the young pair is looking nowhere except each other's eyes. He seems like he could carry them both over the street on great wings of grief tucked under his coat. While all around them float like wisps of ash, or the delicate prism sunlight flashing off the city glass, the orange, yellow, black wing-flecked monarchs. Migrant, they're more than two dozen today, more long-lived than the species who keep to the localized gardens. They're barely a gram apiece, landing, holding still for the common milkweed that feeds their larvae, or balanced on bridges of plume grass stalks and bottle brush, wings fanning, closing, calmed by the long searchlight stems of hollyhock. If they have come for the butterflies, then why is she weeping when he lifts her chin? He looks like he's holding his breath back. Or is he trying to shed tears too? Are any left? He's got his other hand raised, waving, and almost before it stops, the taxi's doors flare on both sides open. Nothing's stirring in the garden. Not us. Not the thinnest breeze among the flowers. Yet by the time we look again, they've flown. Another love poem, I think. Why? So I read this one today at St. Christopher's School because it has the word testicles in it. And there were all these boys. They were 15, 16, 17. They were like, can you say that in a poem? It also has the word shit. I thought they were just going to die. And it was a poetry reading. And they thought, oh, my God, it's a poetry reading. And he said shit. They'd gone to heaven. It was the coolest thing. What smart boys those were. Wow. I seem to be reading, I think, animal poems tonight, as well as love poems, or love poems that are also animal poems, which this one is. Bay. Heat shures the water where it's spilled. Have to get him in just the right spot. It's quick. He'll go heavy when his back hits the grass. Trough like a silver sleeve at the barn side. Now my neighbor flicks, it's thick as a Coke bottle, his hypo. Says, now, and the colt tips over, forgets those slender knees. And now he swabs a spot
have to hurry.
Clippers the musky hide down to the skin, brown as a grocery sack, and ties his hind leg, then the other. It's my job to pull the risen one, spread up. Woody mirage in the mud across the pen, rope behind my neck, arm eagled out along the running guy wire, colt's hoof high in the air. Now my friend's got his vicious tool, more like a sharp sickle or meat hook than a surgical device, but really that's what it is, silver hook to slit the tough skin and tease out the testicle. So he does, hand inside, snip, snip, tossing the first small red wad for the dog. But goddamn is what he says, ooze now, some flesh bubble, and the anesthesia already easing off. Close him up before it's all leaked out. Undeveloped wall and herniating guts where the hand is still half in. Can't do this. But the colt is bobbing his neck, leg pulled harder along my neck rope, a little shit running from his tail. What I meant to say is, it happens so fast. I grabbed his neck, fingers in his mane as he softened first to fall. And that's when I thought of us. Dancing in the dining room, hands in each other's clothes, and the woody bay plant's saucer overfull, and one leaf snapped. That's it. That scent. Never-ending birds. That's us pointing to the clouds. Those are clouds of birds. Now we see. One whole cloud of birds. There we are, pointing out the car windows. October, gray, blue, white, oleo of birds. Never-ending birds, you called the first time. Years, we say it. The three of us, any two of us. One of those just endearments. Apt clarity. Kiss on the lips of hope. I have another house. Now you have two. That's us pointing with our delible whirls into the far away, the true born blue white unfeathering cloud of another year. Another sheet of their never ending. There's your mother wetting back your wild curl. I'm your father. That's us three, pointing out. Dear girl, they will not. It's we who do. End. The feast. The moon tonight is the cup of a scar. I hate the moon. I hate more that scar. My love waited one day, then half the next. One cyst, drained of fluid, that looked, she said, like icing for a cake. Red laced, she said, gold, tan, thick, rich, kind of beautiful. One cyst was not a cyst. One, small one, hard, its edges jagged, like a snowball. This one scared the house oncologist into lab work, stat. Once the snow melts, the birds will be back. Once many men were masked in front of their families, were gunned down to shallow graves, together, there, Basra, Kaichan, East St. Louis, Illinois. Nowhere we don't know about,
and nothing yet is done. This is what we watch while we wait. 12 little cysts of snow in the red bud. I watched each one, having counted once more, and then one more time, as the news reports reported, and the cold, early northern wind shook out there the bare, still-budded small bush. Balls of crust shuddered in the bush. Birds will be back, as though nothing has happened. I am here to report that nothing happened. Except, the oncologist said, then, benign. But now I hate the moon. Hate the scar. Though it shines on her breast like the moon at my lips. These are almost all new poems. I'm reading maybe a poem or two from books, but the rest of these are all, I don't know. New, unfinished. Keats shows up in this one. This is a poem called Posthumous Man. You know that letter that he wrote near the end of his life. When he was describing his own life, he said, I seem to have been living a posthumous existence. Been diagnosed with tuberculosis for a few years. He was trained as a kind of doctor himself. He knew he was a goner. And he was writing from that place. Already gone, already dead. Wow. Pieces of his letters show up a little bit later in this poem. Posthumous man, I hate the world. I have come to the edge. A neighbor's white bean field in the snow fog. 3 weeks of it shedding in the warmth like smoke from fire lines set against the trees, or the season's cold boredom with itself. Mud in the white field, a hump of gray snow. Nothing is there. I hold the dog tight on his leash. Gray snow, gray coat rising now, scuffed like a bad rug, scruff-eared. So we watch nothing rise in the white bean field and shake off a night's sleep and sniff. Sniff, peer over at us. Winter rins in a fluff. Rustle of bramble. He trots off at precisely 180 degrees from where we emerged from the woods into the woods. The long married abide in privacy longer and longer. That's one irony. After hearing the coyote crying a week, 10 days, maybe more, late at night through the glassy air, crying like a bird his song among the billion stars, we saw him sunning asleep in the neighbor's old field. And he woke and saw us and, unafraid, loped off. We rise each morning alone from the shape of our bodies in flannel sheets, burrow beside burrow, where we dream of running, bleeding, food, feral sex, each to his or her own outlandish nightlife. We walk in the world. We sip our coffee at a clean glass table. We love our child, then come to an edge where the world meets the soul. And the soul knows once more what it holds, such capacity to inflict harm or injury, easy as a snowfall and fog's long rise back. It does not, again and again. I hate the world. It batters too much the wings of my self-will. He's writing to Fanny a few weeks cold after the nightingale. He hears it sing in lone, full-throated ease, and knows himself grown specter-thin, even in sweet incense. Full summer, his sadness is a bell's bird call, tolling him back from thee to my soul self. He'll sail himself next year, a man post-poetry and posthumous, too numb to feel the sun over Naples, to heal his scavenger lungs. His hands are white cold. His nails are ridged like a field. He writes to Brown, "Were I in health, it would make me ill," and means, of course, his heart's lack. White trees, white waves. I hear behind me winter wind. It whips the sycamores whose leaves are large as sheaves of paper, brittle, brown, and blowing down. It whips and shakes the blanched bone trunks of beech. Despite the cold, it's humid, a warm exhaust of fog and breathing of the mud. Back down the path I cut one summer, down the ridge and up the drumlin rise beside the creek you're reading, or you're watching out a window where I vanished with a dog. I learned when I should leave this privacy you crave, as I do, the irony thereof. The Sheltie once growling at his leash, loose. But the coyote would kill him simply. So we watch. Long snout, bones slender, his high rear hips. He's a reel of fog unspooling toward the far half-shadowed rim of trees. Uptick of grackles, more wrens. He's loping. Now he's running through the field toward the woods. By the time he is halfway, he is gone. Another bird poem. I'm reading this poem because it's 5 o'clock in the morning this morning when I'm out on the highway driving from my little village in rural Ohio to the Columbus airport. I can barely see. I haven't had coffee. I haven't taken a shower. It's ridiculously early. I'm driving my truck and wow, this huge vehicle passes me going 7 billion miles an hour, a Hummer. You know those? Oh my God, this thing just blew me off the road. This is a poem called Hummer. My friend who used to teach here, Terry Hummer, thinks this is about him. In fact, I wanted to think of every use of that word I could think of in this poem, but that. It's just about the little birds. You ever watch them? I have bird feeders. Meanest little things you've ever seen in your life. Have you seen them? You ever seen more than one hummingbird at a feeder? Mm-mm. You know why? Because they just like the truck. That's the point. Now I don't need to read the poem. I have another one. Hummer. The greater, the lesser. The cars bulked up and armored for the exurban panic room set, for whom a wide wheelbase is a military presence on the highway, superior if insecure in its security. A strip of highway, and then they blow by. And the long blast, after effect, like the pitch that flies by the same name, the brush-back warning shot of a little chin music, what the veterans call from the dugout. All you see is a wing, then feel the whir. They're out there now, the lesser, the faster, each fury-born blur with a ruby ribbon at the throat of the meanest thing on wings, diving to suckle at sugar water tubes we dangle from our pin oaks, stealing sips from coral bells, or the pink hoods and human poisons of a foxglove. We love to watch them. Though watch precisely isn't right, they shoot, dart, flipper away at astonishing rates, 75 wing and 12 heartbeats per second, unless courting, during which the tenuous wing member vibrates 200 times a tick. All we catch is a pencil line fading in water escape, or the rare instance of a landing, when one whirs to a pine bough, blue finger with a beak, then back, back to bombing each other, bumping windows. What drives them if not hunger's hundred shapes? Hatred, thirst, mania, survival, force of habit. Each is greater than the last, according to the laws of compensation and revenge. Here's another bird one. There's a lot of action in that one. Almost nothing happens in this one. The world will give you a poem if you just pay attention. This one is called The Blue. Keats showed up a minute ago. Dickinson shows up here a little bit. The blue heron is gray, not blue, but great enough against brown-tipped bowed cattails to be well-named, is known for its stealth, shyer than a cloud, but won't fly or float away when it's scared, stands there thinking maybe it's invisible, though it's not. Tall, gray, straight as a pole among the cloudy reeds. Then it picks up one stem leg. This takes time, and sets it down just beyond the other. No splash, breath of a ripple goes on slowly across the silt, mud, algae throttled surface through sedge grass to stand to its knees in water turning grayer now that afternoon is evening. Now that afternoon is evening, the gray heron turns blue, bluer than sky, bluer than the mercury blue black still pond. So when did it snag the bullfrog hanging, kicking in its scissor beak? To look so long means to miss the sudden. It strides around like a sleek cat from pond to bank and back, blue tall bird, washing the frog, banging it against stones, pecking almost as if it doesn't know what to do now that it's caught such a thing. How fast its beak must be to shoot out like an arrow, or that certain, as it's called, slant of light, blue light. Where did it go? Hyper. Then a stillness descended the blue hills. I say, stillness. There were three deer. Then four. They crept down the old bean field, these four deer, for 15 minutes, more, as we watched them in the field, in the sowing snow. That's how slowly they moved in stillness. Slender deer. The fourth limped behind the other three. We could see, even in the darkness, as it dragged its right hindquarter where it was hit. Or shot. Katie sat back on her heels. The dog held in his prance, or Kate held him, hardly breathing at first. Then we relaxed. Blue night descended our neighbor's blown hills. and the calm that comes with seeing something beautiful, but far from perfect, descended. Absolute attention, a fixity. I say absolute, it was stillness. In the books we gathered, the first theory holds that the condition's emergence is most common at age 8, if less in girls than boys, or more vividly seen in boys whose fidgets, whose deficit attentions, like little psychoeconomic realms, are prone to twitches turned to virulence, anxieties palpable in vocalized explosions. Though we know now, in girls, it's only on the surface less severe, which explains her months of bubbling tension, her long blue drifts, and snowy distractions. I say distractions. Of course, I mean how clinically tyrosine hydroxylase activity, the rate-limiting enzyme in dopamine synthesis, disrupts, burns, then rewires her brain's chemical pathways. Let me put it another way. After 24 math problems, the 25th still baffles her. Pencil gnawed. Eraser scuff shadows like black veins on her homework. It's not just the theory of division she no longer gets. It's her hot clothes, her itchy ear, the ruby-throated hummingbird's picture on the fridge. What's in the fridge? Whose socks these are? Why? Until I'm exhausted and yell again. Until she's gone away to her room. Lights off, to sulk, read, cry, draw. No longer trusting to memory, she writes everything in her journal now, then ties it with a broken strand of necklace. Of her friends, I am the funny one. Mom, she has red hair and freckles too. Under Dad, I have his bad temper. I know. I looked. In one sketch, she finished, just before we learned what was wrong. I mean, before we knew what to call what was wrong, how to treat it, how to treat her, she captured her favorite cat with a skill that skips across my chest. He's on a throw rug, asleep. The rug's fringe ruffles just so. The measure of her love is visible in each delicate stroke. From his fetal repose, ears down, eyes sealed softly, paws curled inward, to the tiger lines of his coat, deepened by thick textures where she's slightly rubbed away the contours with her thumb to winter coat gray. He's soft. He's purring. He's utterly relaxed asleep. One day, before we learned what was wrong, she taped it to a pillow on my bed. Terry is tired, she'd printed at the top. How many ways do we measure things by what they're not? I say, things. Mostly her mind is going too fast. Yet the doctors give her, I'm not kidding, amphetamines. Speed, we used to say, when we needed it. Ritalin, which wears off hard and often. Adderall, which lasts all day, though her food's untouched, and sleep comes late. The irony is, the medicine slows her down. She pays attention, understands things. The theory is ADHD patients aren't hyper-aroused. They're under-aroused. So they lurch and hurtle forward, hungry for focus. Another theory says the brain's two lobes are missized. Their circuits lose their balance. One makes much of handedness. Left. Red hair. Allergies, wan skin, an Irish past. We watched four deer in stillness walking there. Stillness walking. Like the young blue deer, hurt but beautiful. In her theory of division, Katie's started drawing them. Her renderings reduced them down to three. She has carefully lined the cut bean rows in contours, like the dog's brushed coat. Snowflakes dot the winter paper. Two small deer stand alert on either side of the hurt one, leaning now to bite the season's dried up stems. Their ears are perched like hands, noses up, tails tufted in 100 tiny pencil lines. She's been hunkered over her drawing pad, humming for an hour. So I watch. I say, watch. I ask why she's made the little hurt one so big. Silly. He's not hurt that bad, she says. She doesn't look up. That one's you. I think I'll just read one more poem. With my deep thanks for the invitation to read to you tonight, and my thanks to you for coming tonight, when you could be, well, just think of all the things you could be doing. And you've come to a little room to listen to poems. That's an encouraging thing. I have sat in this room hundreds of times like you. Rooms like this and listen to people read poems. It's a pretty nice thing, and I'm honored by your attention. It's just one more little one. Too many. Too many, my neighbors say, when what they mean are deer, the foragers, the few at a time. Fair, if little more than rats, according to my farmer friend nearby, whose corn means plenty. They nip the peaches, and one bite ruins. Hazard every road with their running into headlights, not away. A menace. Plague. Something should be done. Or, here in town, where I've found a kind of afterlife, the townies hate the damage to their variegated hostas. Shadeside, ferns, what they do inside white bunkers of the county's one good course is criminal. Deep scuffs through the sand. That's one thing, but lush piles of polished olive droppings, hoof ruts, in the chemically and color-enriched greens. Yet here's one more. Curled like a tan seashell, not a foot from my blade, just come to the world fawn. Speckled, wet as a trout, which I didn't see. Hacking back brush beneath my tulip poplar. It's not afraid. Mews like a kitten. Can't walk. There are so many. Too many of us, the world keeps saying. And the world keeps making. This makes no sense. More. Thanks.